A recorder joined.
Okay. Welcome, everyone. So we have our second creator discussion, and if anybody wants to come up with a different name for this, that's fine, too. So there's two items on the agenda that, at least that I can remember right now. One was to talk about the process of curation that WormBase does, and a PDF was sent around, or a link to the PDF was sent around for everybody to look at. I think here we're not so much going to try to focus on the exact annotation, but it's more the process of editing that is of interest to me, at least. And then the second thing was to try to talk about, so one issue that's come up for me recently is at what point do we decide what to say to the community? So, for example, if you have a software release, how often do you make software releases and how big a deal do you make of them? Same would go for data releases, all these kind of things. So it's how do you interact with the community as far as sort of specific standards that your group puts forward? And if we can also deal with how do we interact with our community? Is email what we do? Do we put it on the website? Do we use RSS? You know, which of these actually work would be a fine place to start, and which ones don't? Any ideas of sort of how to move that forward? Certainly for us here at STD, one of the big problems is really, you know, how do we actually reach our community? These groups are very diverse, and, you know, email seems like the old way to do it, but do people really read email anymore that, it, you know, three-quarters of your mail is spam? So I thought we could start with the WormBase paper, but I'm certainly willing and to entertain other ideas. Okay.
Okay, Andrew's here.
Hello. Well, I think it's I think there's quite a bit of information that was sent out, so I don't want to really go over it unless people want me to. Maybe we can, you know, there'll be some questions we could answer, or I don't know what's the best format for this.
Well, maybe just start by summarizing, and if nothing else, you had, the last two pages of the PDF. Just sort of to mention what that is, and certainly your final draft. Maybe just talk people through that, if you like.
Yes. So basically, in WormBase, we have a sort of two-step curation process. Where in the step one, and that's what actually was mailed out, we flag data in the papers. So we don't really extract at that stage almost any data at the first stage. It's just about flagging and highlighting the data that we are interested in. And this various data types later got emailed to people who actually will do the extraction. Or the flagging is stored in our database for later use. And the snapshot at the end of the PDF that Mike mentioned is it's just kind of our cumulative summary of we look at like more than 4,000 papers now, and we kind of average or just cumulatively show what type of data types are represented. So it's sort of an average. You can think about it as just an average paper. You know what it has. You know what sort of data it most likely have. We have expression data and RNAi as the most common fields. And then it sort of decreases. You know, the other fields are less likely to be represented in an average CLGAS paper. I think that's it for the summary.
I just actually wonder
So you do the first pass and you annotate the paper within PDF?
We don't. I did it just to kind of make it easier for people to follow, especially North Sea Alliance people, what, you know, when we talk about gene function, you know, what exactly we mean, and the examples are highlighted in PDF. So what we, in reality, what we have is a Postgres database and a first pass curation form that links to it. And we fill short comments in the curation form. And I think there's a page attached to the, it's like one of the last pages in PDF that actually, that was what actually filled in the curation, first pass curation form. So it's very, very short sentences, expression, figure four, and so on. That's as much as we filled in during first pass.
So in looking at this, I noticed that you have, 400 roughly papers that have something to do with the gene sequence or gene name, but how do you, I'm assuming that all of the other papers, it's fairly easy to figure out what gene they're talking about for you guys?
What is the question? How do first pass curator points out the genes he flags? What is the? I guess I didn't understand the question.
How do you know? I mean, one of the first passes has to be to determine, you know, A, that it's a C. elegans gene, and B, what it is, what gene it is. So, I mean, I would think all of your papers would have that information, right?
Well, this some of these fields, they're a little bit cryptic because actually this one actually contains several subfields. So what we usually what we're interested in is if there is a clone gene that has not been assigned to sequence. So we would flag that as a...
There's also papers in which there's no genes at all. They could be papers that are just about cells and behavior, and those would be curated.
Also, these are new, right, Andre?
Yes, I mean, we do... this data, you know, a lot of the data we're interested in, it has to be, you know, new.
But how do you know that there's C. elegans genes?
Yes, the C. elegans is pretty easy. We have it's typical 3-4 letter gene, 3-4 letters and dash and number. That's, you know, you see them. You know, it's you know, if they fall under the nomenclature, most people, authors do. It's pretty clear that it's a C. elegans gene. You know, sometimes you have to dig in deeper. You know, there are cases where we don't. It's not clear after reading a whole paper. You know what. What gene they're talking about, because they often, it appears people tend to, you know, kind of hide that it's not a mammalian gene, and at least I saw cases like that. It's not, it's very, you know, not obvious that it's...
Could we talk just a second among the groups about the one point of organism identification with the papers? Because I think for some databases, that's a more difficult issue than for others,
right,
in which the organism isn't clearly stated in the title, abstract, and you might, if you're really lucky, find it in materials and methods. So for a number of databases, I think that's more of a difficult problem than for others, and I'd be interested to hear some comments from those people.
Well, I mean, those things, I mean, I'm here first time, so I should introduce myself. I'm actually running the IP at UCLA. So this is protein-protein interaction database. And in terms of whatever you mentioned about identifying proteins, it varies between the organs. We're dealing with the just interaction, so it's cross-section through whatever is there. And
And obviously some species are much, much easier than the others. The most nice out of those is the yeast, obviously. It's pretty regular nomenclature, and it's not that of a problem. The rest is a mess. The rest is a mess. Sometimes you end up with gene acronym and no chance to guess what's the species.
Yes.
And sometimes you've got a situation where you've got, let's say, five proteins in a paper. Four of them are, let's say, human and referred to as human. You would guess that the fifth one is human, mm-hmm. but there's not the word in the paper. There's acknowledgement to someone for providing a construct, and then you furiously go through a series of papers trying to get to the, and you discover that this fifth protein is not human but from mouse.
Yeah, so we read that as well.
I mean, you've got all the possible cases, and sometimes you try to email people on the author's list, and sometimes they respond, sometimes they don't. It's all the possible versions of that, and this thing goes down with decreasing interest of the authors in a protein. So if, for example, there are controls provided, it's much harder to get information. What was this control protein? Because they give you acronym and they don't care much. They pull something out of the fridge probably to do a control for a Westerner. And there is information there. Every repeat of experiment we do care about. So even if it's control, we do put this thing into database, but then it's pretty hard to find the information there. So it's a whole spectrum.
So this is David Hill from MGI, and we find exactly the same problem, is that oftentimes you're reading papers and they'll use a gene symbol, but you'll have no idea what organism they got the protein from. I think I don't know how we could do it, but one thing that as a curator group we could try to do is convince publishers that there should be some minimum standard for when you're reporting about a protein or you're reporting about a gene, you should give the following information about it. Because there's a lot of papers that we throw out just because you can't figure out what organism the gene product came from. And the papers do good, you know, they do good work in the paper, you just have no idea where that protein came from.
Wow. And we find the same thing at RGD, and that's one of the reasons I stopped us at that point, because I do think it's something that our organization could ask for as minimal standards, is really indicating organism for the biomaterials that are used and described in the paper. I'm sure for mouse it's very similar. When we get to mouse, human, and rat, people really don't distinguish, and in many cases our literature is designed by the author to look like it is for human for many, many reasons, particularly disease-oriented papers.
Yeah.
And it is in terms of search and retrieval, depending on how you do your literature searches, is an issue.
Nice.
And David, speaking of those standards, you know, so many times these genes are gifts from someone. If it's a gift, say the species from which the gift came from.
Yeah,
but the gift doesn't tell me anything.
Sometimes they also say, you know, we use the following construct, and then they give a reference to a paper, and then you can spend a day tracking down that actual construct
and
is. So I don't even think it's good enough to give a reference. I think that they need to say what species the gene came from and what the gene is.
Right.
And in that case, it's only one extra word in the manuscript.
Exactly.
You don't have to mention it again.
Right.
They can even stick it in the methods. They don't even have to interrupt the flow of their main.
Right.
Stick it in the methods.
Hi, this is Rama. What percentage of the papers do you think don't mention any gene name within your model organism?
Well, you see, that's a difficult question to answer because of the way that we do our triage now. We actually search first on mouse, mice, or murine. And then if we're looking at a specific gene, for example, for Go, we look for cell lines that we know are mouse cell lines if we want to, for example, find in vitro data. So it's hard to say, you know, what percentage of the papers out there don't.
Right. I mean,
We also search based on rats, ratus, rats. However, we are at the mercy of the mesh indexers to have annotated that to a certain extent and for it to be somewhere in the paper for the search to work well. And when there's multiple species, the indexers tend to put nothing or they'll put human, and it often isn't indicated in the paper well enough. We do both searching by particular topics and by particular genes, so we've seen issues both ways.
But even searching using rat or ratus or rats in the search, lots of times you'll come up with, I would guess, 25-30% of the papers you have to kick out because you have no idea what the species is of the particular protein that you're looking at.
Yeah.
Sometimes there'll be four proteins, and like he said, four of them will say and one of them won't. One of them was a kind gift from somebody or another.
Or else you have the rat cell line, but it's been the human or the mouse gene that has
right.
been transfected.
Right.
I think the problem is that you have to convince people it's in their long-term interest to add this information.
Yes, it's just a general comment because it seems the problem is repeated every time you talk to someone who's dealing with curation. It's gonna be the same thing. I happen to be sitting by a desk of a guy who's helping people to submit data into PDB. And this is literally a hell. They go through like a cycles of it can take weeks to submit one structure there. But those people tend to appreciate that whatever is coming out of PDB then helps them directly to solve structures. So there's a feedback. With other types of databases, it's not that many people at the bench who realize that whatever they are getting out of Swiss, Prot, SVD, and all of that is actually done manually by curators, that they do get this data from papers. And then there's no feedback.
Yeah, I think you have a good point there, and that is a lot of people don't realize that a curator is going to read their paper and try to extract data from it.
So,
and a lot of people don't care what,
yeah.
you know, if you're working in a lab and you're working on a protein that's important in human disease, you tend to think of the protein as the protein and not really specifically what mortal organism, is involved in the experiment.
This is Pascal from Dictybase. I think as a group we really should, start doing what Tara's done with Selfies for Go, but just generally to talk to all the editors and ask for at least organisms and ID for every, protein or gene which is mentioned in a paper, because it's the only place where you have control over what the authors will do. Because even the reviewers, they'll go over some stuff, but they won't necessarily bother to look if the IDs are missing.
Well, no, with reviewers, it's I can imagine how it works. The reviewers are people from the field, from a given time.
Yeah, so they know what they're talking about.
So they don't even think about. So I was talking to experimental people like 2 days ago, 3 days ago, and they told me, it was cDNA library from, and to them it was obvious it's human.
Mm-hmm.
In the description they gave me, there was not the word, it's human. And they were working with human and the mouse things. And to them it was obvious.
But, I would be surprised. They might be even thinking that it is, and they're wrong sometimes, too.
No, but it's true. It should go probably editors are the place where there's leverage.
And
so,
I think as a group, we should just write a letter and, all the databases would find it and write, make it really simple for the beginning, just to make sure every paper has organism and a protein ID, and then take it further after.
So what's the status? There was on the mailing list. There were a few snapshots of the form from Tara, I think.
Yeah.
So what's the status of this thing? Is it just the mock-up pages or? Mm-hmm.
And the form from, I think the shots that were shown was something that Judy had thrown together as an idea to.
Yes, this is Judy. We're working with the PLOS journals to incorporate that so that they would provide the official
or some ID for the gene and some ID for the taxon and whatever freeform information they wanted about every gene or protein discussed in the paper. So at the moment, we're taking it to PLOS journals, but certainly it can go elsewhere for people's special journals.
I just wonder, is there any way to set up, because if it's going to be every journal with different form and different page and different layout, it's going to be as confusing, because you've had one author which publishing in different papers, and then they're going to have to deal with a gazillion of different things. I just wonder if there's one possible, is it possible to have a one template, one thing which is uniform across everything?
I think that would be really, really good.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, otherwise it's not going to work.
Because
so
then there was this information about the MINT people and FEPs and
mm-hmm.
providing interaction data or experiments. Well, so this is another effort. They do look different. To make it more entertaining, we're collaborating actually with MINT and with Intact, and we're trying to do curation together. We're splitting the load, which is reasonable. What's less reasonable is that apparently every database is trying to get authors somehow contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And on the IP side, we've got a page or a way to get data from the authors. But apparently Intact has a different version of that, and then MINT has a different version of that. So then it is one huge confusion from the side of the authors. So if it's possible to get something common to all the databases, no matter interactions or functional annotation or whatever, it would be probably much, much more reasonable.
Well, this is Paul Sundberg. So one question is, do you want very simple metadata, which might be the easiest thing, rather than, you know, very detailed curation about specific topics, which is going to take a long time for us to hammer out in general.
Right.
I mean,
right? So I would say that we should focus on, you know, gene ID, a core set like species identifiers, gene IDs or protein IDs, some really small set.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, exactly. I mean,
right, better would be just even listing the data types, like this includes interactions, right? And then MINT and BioGrid and Armbase and FlyBase and every other place base can go find it. And then but I do agree that it should be, it can't be journal specific, because each journal website, the concern of the journals are that their websites have to be changed and modified.
Mm-hmm. I think
right. So if we had forms that were, hosted elsewhere, and that part of the editorial process should be, please, you have to be confirmed that you stated what's in the paper.
I mean, I think the easiest thing, and it wouldn't cost the journals anything, would be just the mere inclusion of the species in front of the first mention of the construct in their materials and methods.
I agree with Carol.
That's a no-brainer, no cost. And if the editorial board of the journal doesn't have the idea.
Yeah, but that doesn't really work for me. This is Judy, because what ultimately you need is IDs. And so, I mean, if the paper was published with a couple relevant IDs, it would be much better.
I agree with Judy, because there are a lot of issues when you get into multiple isoforms and they don't actually identify them very well. In addition, if we're going to go for identification, because we all do a variety of papers, I would think, in addition to the species, the specific strain that was used should be identified.
Certainly. I agree with you.
So it sounds the bare minimum is just identifiers of proteins or genes or whatever entities you're dealing with, and it's same on our side. I mean, if this information is provided in a systematic way for every paper, and whoever is curating paper knows that all the proteins are listed there, all the genes are listed there, it's already taking probably like 50-70% of time spent on curation, because in reality, you're going in a fast pace through a few papers, and then you're stuck for a day because there's something you can't find going, and you're starting to trace back papers.
Yeah. And it's not only the time that you're wasting, it's the information that you don't end up providing because you discard an article because you don't know the thesis. And the article may have, in fact, very good information or results, and those are not made available.
Exactly.
This is Ruth. Sorry, I've got a concern about people putting a lot of data in, because I think I used to work at the Hugo Genomics Committee, and we had a lot of trouble just getting gene symbols that we'd approved to be accepted by the journals. So if you say that you want all the authors to work out exactly what piece of DNA they've used, or what exact protein boundaries they're kind of expressing or whatever, the journals will know that their authors won't do that. It's just too much because there isn't an identifier necessarily for the, I don't know, the echo sites that they've used hasn't necessarily got an identifier that's going to cut down to that level. So,
but I don't think we're asking for that level. We just want a gene ID.
Right. Well, you were and you weren't. If you talk about isoforms and things like that, then you're starting to talk
but
about how much detail you're putting in.
I agree with Tanya that we should keep it like as general as possible because it's, you know, Ruth, you're right that then, you know, of course we won't make any. If we put the bar too high, people will not provide. But it's amazing that, you know, so many databases have problems with just knowing is this a mouse paper or not. I mean, you know, there's some basic stuff that you shouldn't have to read a paper 15 times to know if it's talking about your organism or not.
Well, I mean, it's scary because normally it should be, I mean, this is how papers should be published, right? That you should provide enough information for someone else to represent the experiment.
Your paper is rejected until you put in
I think
data.
We can remind the research community that this is not just to benefit the curators. The same day that we have to take trying to figure out what organism a construct comes from, the researchers in the lab have to do the same thing.
Right.
So it's not just for us. It's really for all of them that are reading the literature, too.
Yeah.
I completely agree. I just think you have to be maybe give a grade of things to the journals. If you were going to write a letter to the journals, then it would be a case of this is the very minimum. It's the bare minimum that every single method next to every cDNA construct, you write the species. And that's at least the minimum you do. And then you work up to how nice it would be if they actually put accession IDs in.
Yeah. I can tell you this, so this is Tanya again from TARE, from my presentation to the Plant Phys editorial board, is when I pitched the idea to them of, you know, trying to collect data, is I really pitched it as, you know, the fact that it's great for curators is kind of a side benefit, but the real benefit is to the research community, to the journals, because you're disseminating the information, you're making it more visible in more places, and so of course, you know, from my viewpoint, it's very selfish. I want it because it benefits curators, but for them to get in on the act, it has to be good for them. So that's how that's how it needs to be pitched.
This is Mike. On the PLOS journals, they require the gene symbol and a gene ID for papers. So at least at that level, I mean, it works for PLOS, and you know, you don't have to I get the point about the different isoforms and an ID for those, but presumably there's some level of a gene ID. The other thing that I wanted to add here is that here at SCD, we don't have so much of an issue of the species, but we do of the strain.
Yeah.
And people would just make up a number and say, this is strain 6, but that doesn't mean anything.
No. We all have that issue. And in fact, they misidentify strains as well. But some journals are requiring. We have had people, authors contact us, and in fact, authors in our own building who will contact us, who've been told from multiple journals to make sure that their nomenclature is in fact correct for not only the genes but also the strains and QTLs that they have in their papers. So there is some consciousness out there. There's also some consciousness that people are creating text mining tools, and another way to sell it is that all of these things lend themselves to such software that is being developed. I mean, there isn't a journal out there who doesn't understand that.
Yeah.
Great.
So do we think we want to, you know, as far as where do we go from here, is do we want to start drafting a letter already? Do we want to wait until there's kind of a society in place to give us kind of some aura of legitimacy? Or?
Well, I don't think we need to wait for the society. I mean, that just because, you know, unless we had a real hard date for that itself. But it seems that drafting the letter will allow us to sort of to talk about the specifics that we want to suggest, and also deal with things that are actually too complex for particular fields and things. But I think if we can get something like that together, which you know may take a little while for us just to hash it out and get it simple, I think that would be good. One thought I had is actually, I have to credit Judy for this, that she was suggesting that we start putting some information up on a wiki or something like that, and it seems in this discussion we've just had that we could have, I'm not sure what wiki we would put it on, but we'd find someplace where each group sort of annotates, if you like, or comments events on the issues that they have within this particular category of information, species, strain, gene names and things. And then at least if seeing that collection as we're writing the paper, you know, everybody would have a good view of what the overall problems are. Anyway, so I'll send some email about that. We don't necessarily have to decide that over the phone call.
I mean, two things. One thing is we do have a system where we trace papers for the IP. And in principle, we can grant access to the site where you can get papers that do have interactions. They are not annotated with species or anything like that at the top level. But there's at least a list of papers that have been already processed, and it means that proteins there were identified. So this is something we can somehow arrange so that people can actually check what are the new papers there, and then it's a better starting point than totally annotated. And then the second issue is there's gonna be a meeting next week of HUPO PSI. This is HUPO Proteomics Standards Initiative, which seems to deal with things like that, like development of standards and curation and so forth. And maybe there's a way to get something together with those guys. Actually, I'm going to be there, so I know maybe there's a way to get somehow together and get this letter sent out in a broader context. I mean, I wouldn't care about the level of details and so forth. There are people dealing with protein interactions who would want probably more. But I'd be perfectly happy if I'm guaranteed that the paper I'm getting does come with a list of proteins and identifiers. So I would be all for that.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of the guesswork out of it.
Mm-hmm.
It saves probably 50 to 70% of time just that you know what are the proteins you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can go on from there because then you're annotating. And on the other hand, it's probably easier for the authors to provide information about what proteins are working with, because this is relatively simple in terms of annotating experiments in different way. It's a mess. It takes actually time to train curators to annotate papers in a proper way. So then I somehow can't imagine that each author is going to learn intricacies of annotation and then old ontology terms and things like that just to annotate things properly. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't think that what we're asking for, though, is for an author to annotate something properly. We're just asking them to tell us what it is they're
working. Yeah, right, just right. Object ID, that's it.
Yeah,
and
so
they should be familiar with that concept by now, and it's going to be a great way to teach them to learn to use databases if they're not.
Any paper that I take a long time, because I don't know some of the pieces, who they belong to.
This is Kate from CARE. I just had a question of clarification. Someone had mentioned the idea that perhaps there should be one form that would be externally hosted, and then that data could be relayed to any journal that someone submitted to. Is that the proposal, or is the proposal that each journal would have their own form or would have some copy of this standard form?
Okay, so this is Paul. So I think the question is whether I think either is a problem because if each journal, then each journal has to, you know, work out the form themselves, and that might, there might be some resistance. So that was why I was saying it should be external, and then just they would just require an accession number or some feedback. But then the question is who's going to, you know, there could be a lot of different hosts, right? So if it's a mouse paper, then MGI would sign off on it, right?
But then, Cecilia from PIR, isn't going to be a hassle if you have a paper dealing with a different proteins from different organisms going to different, I mean, for the authors, it's going to be
frankly,
a mess.
This is Judy. I think it's going to be a journal-specific issue to do this because they wrap, my vision is that they wrap it into their data, into their
right.
manuscript submission process. And so they have different manual, they have different they're just going to have to add another page or whatever to incorporate this into their pipeline, and journals may do it at different stages. Some of them may choose to do it in the final publication process and not in the data the submission of the manuscript process.
Okay, Judy. So the one thing is, what I would envision is we want to get something the minimal, you know, generally agreed information like the species, strains, gene IDs. And then, if we want to build on that, right? If each journal develops that, they're not going to want to change it. They'll change it every 3 years, or 5 years, right? If it's hosted externally, it could be changed much more, you know, every 6 months or every year.
You could gradually ramp it up the
demands on the author.
Yeah, but how do you make sure if it's hosted externally that it gets into the paper?
Actually, it's like GenBank IDs
that have to go. You'd say that it has to be signed off.
No, look, we've done this with nomenclature, and that's hard enough to get the rollover. I think so. I should probably send out some of the things that we've been developing, and the TARE thing should be sent out because what it's looking for, what in both situations you're looking for ID for a protein, ID for the molecule, ID for the taxon, and then some statement of what they showed in colloquial terms and what assay they used. And that information can be translated by the curator. And then you ask that for each molecule that's experimentally analyzed in the paper. I think that, and then you can have drop-down lists for the common taxon IDs for the major model organism taxons and stuff like that. I mean, I think the much harder problem is to even think about incorporating strains into this because most people have no concept that there is a strain nomenclature or anything about it. They use shorthand and they just are not aware of that aspect.
Well, this is Karen Prince from SGD. Even when people are aware about the strains, and we tried to collect strain information for 6 months, and the information we collected has so little background on what the strain background is that even if they report their lab strain name, you still don't know what it is. And a colleague told back to me that he thought collecting strain information was useless. So strain information seems a little trickier, but knowing at least what organism and what genes or proteins they're working on, that seems pretty basic. The strain information is, and a lot of people report, have whole strain tables for their busy eye. And it's still useless because you don't know what their strain background is.
Well, you know, I think strain information, the importance of it probably varies between the model organism as well.
Strain information is very important, yes. This is Elisabetta Karpova from UAB. We are curating viruses. Strain, of course, very important.
Well, of course, that's true. I mean, I think the awareness of it, though, may also vary among different communities. I mean, certainly most mouse researchers at this point are fairly aware of the mouse strains they're using because that's quite important.
Once it's a piece of DNA in a test tube, you don't know whether it's black 6 or what have you.
There are some. I'll chime in for RAT. There are some in the community who are very aware and have very good records.
Thank you, Mary. I agree. I would not denigrate all mouse geneticists.
But I would say some. And I believe after we have our $1,000 genome, we will find all kinds of things that people thought they had and don't have. But I do think there are some journals, Nature Genetics is one, that actually does ask authors to check to make sure that their strain nomenclature is correct. At least for RAT, we're getting those requests. So there's a growing knowledge and awareness. I wouldn't abandon it altogether. I think we can think about it.
Yeah, the point about the genomes, we're already starting to see that in yeast with the genomes of strains being sequenced and then people being able to check for SNPs and strains that they have been using for years. They realize that the genealogy of the particular strain is wrong and that they've actually been working on something else for a decade.
Yes. The curators here who handle strain nomenclature are eagerly awaiting that epic in our life to rename everything.
I mean, and yeast is probably similar. Some people are very good, but enough people aren't that the data set as a whole was just not tremendously useful.
Hi, this is Rama from STD. I want to make a comment about Paul and Judy's point about where the form should be, where the authors input the strain gene ID information. What do you guys think about having PubMed do it? Because they anyway have the authors submit the gene sequence information to GenBank. So if PubMed can say that you authors have to submit this information to PubMed before your paper can be indexed, then it's just one authority that's controlling all this information rather than multiple journals controlling the form and stuff like that.
I don't see how they can enforce that. That's the problem.
They enforce it for DNA sequence. If you clone, they don't enforce it.
If you provide, they'll put it, but they won't enforce it.
Right.
The enforcement comes from the journals on providing
exactly.
A GenBank ID. It does not come from PubMed.
Right. So, you know, we need, I think the journals are the best way because at least you have something to tell the author. If you don't do this, your paper will not be in press. And so that's kind of a good argument.
Well, so that actually brings up a point. So it's with the GenBank issues, people didn't, as I understand it, didn't go out to the journals and say, require this. There was this meeting, and all the research community said, we have to do this. And then they transmitted that to the journals and saying, we think you have to do this.
No, actually, that came from the International Nucleotide Group of EMBL, DDBJ, and GenBank, who, because at that time, sequences were curated by hand and typed out of journal articles. And they actually went to journals and required, worked with the journals to require it.
So that's the sort of same point, that if we get together and actually include some of the scientific community, I think that the weight of that, you know, the journals will accept.
Is there a way, this is Kate from TARE, is there a way that rather than, in a sense, hosting something externally, what if there were, let's say, a form that were developed by biocurators and other scientists where part of the submission process at any journal was that you had to upload this form?
Yeah,
so that the form could be easily manipulated, quickly changed, and each journal would just require the people to upload that form to them.
Then where do you send it once you filled it out?
Yeah. At the
journal, each journal for one of its pages in the submission process would be upload form X.
Right.
And so that's a great idea. But then each mod would have to go to all of the journals and find the ones that are appropriate for them? I mean, I guess that could work.
This information would be somehow included in the paper.
Maybe like supplemental material.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then we could parse it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for any species mentioned in the forum,
so there would just be like
email.
We talked about this before, a little database section that would say, you know, taxon ID, gene IDs, blah, blah, strain IDs, and then we could just pull that in and verify it.
So maybe there's a way to actually host this form or whatever is underlying under the form in whatever number of places, doesn't matter where, it can be actually distributed as a piece of program. Whoever wants to install locally, they can install locally. And then this thing spits out a very simple file with literally one row per protein or molecule in a paper. And then the requirement on the journal side would be just provide this file. And here's a list of sites you can use to actually generate this file, and this would be a requirement for publication.
Yeah, I think that would work.
The key point is that it can't be too complicated, because then there's going to be huge resistance from everybody who's supposed to provide it. It should be as simple as possible, as uniform as possible. So I would think at lowest useful level of information there. I mean, because if something's there, then in a year, and if it works, then in a year or 2 years, you can try to upgrade this thing, add extra information, and show that this is useful. But the starting point should be
very. I think it should end up being a page of the final article, at least, because I think if you have the onus on the journal publishers to keep some external database, like even for supplemental data, sometimes supplemental data links disappear over time.
Right.
You don't keep them up.
I think integrating into the article is a better way.
Yeah. As long as it's not PDF, I've seen hundreds of pages of supplemental information as a PDF, and then you're cutting and pasting 100 pages of a table, because journal publishes only attachments or supplements as PDF files.
It should be like keywords in the front of the paper.
Yeah, like where keywords would go, instead of having keywords, you would have
bioinformatic
data or something.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea, because it would lend itself to any kind of text mining tool that people would be able to create on only abstracts.
And I think the key is, I mean, if we're not going to have you know, people go out and look for these, we're going to have to text mine them. So they have to be in a format that's easily parsable.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. See, the problem with the inclusion of those in a paper is that there's increasing number of papers doing things on a genome scale, and then it would mean that those papers cannot provide a list of identifiers.
But hold on, these are the only ones that have identifiers usually.
Probably.
Well,
yeah,
those are the easy ones.
Yeah,
it's just the information is very limited.
That abstract, Pascal.
I'm sorry.
Right? You're not going to want to have that like underneath the abstract.
Oh. Okay. Sure.
That's true.
We just need to know this is a genome-wide screen for Drosophila melanogaster.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have to go and pull out the tables.
Yeah.
Right? But at least you just need to know it's genome scale. And
okay,
what,
so if there's more than 1,000 IDs, they don't need to answer them all.
Right.
You could provide a bulk upload thing, right? So you just put in your list of identifiers. You're
right.
Type.
But typically, you see...
The microarray data, everybody's required to upload their microarray data to GEO or Microarray Express, and it doesn't happen. So... we're not going to add in extra. We just want to say there is a genome-wide experiment in this paper of this form,
and
microarrays.
Probably the journal editor the journal publishers, editors, whatever, they can probably help us with the specifics of this. You know, they, I don't know, probably know at least better than me how to go about, you know, doing this.
I don't know editors, but if I were one... And then I had a group of people telling me what I'm supposed to stick in front of my paper I'm publishing. I'd be pretty upset, probably more than if, okay, you're supposed to add this extra file somewhere. somewhere.
Well, yeah, so, but maybe a file would work for us too if it was linked to the paper or somewhere, you know, like, I don't know. I think the specifics are.
Anyone else? They already tell you how to format the reference sheet. See, I don't see whether they would have a big issue with this.
Really. Yeah.
Well, but
I mean, they get, you know, you go to a journal, you get this whole list, and these are the rules that your paper has to be before it gets published, and people do it.
Well,
can
I suggest,
when they do it.
Can I suggest that maybe it's worth contacting, say, 5 or 6 of the top journals and finding out what they would consider as the most appropriate if something like this is going to be implemented?
Yeah, I think that.
And have a sort of working group of discussions with them, and then you have a more realistic idea about what would be appropriate.
Yeah, certainly with the big publishers, you know, PLOS and Elsevier and Wiley and you know, a few others maybe. Because they would likely do it across all their journals.
Yeah,
is my guess. So you know, you could probably deal with a small group to at least work through this, and then you know, then the others would hopefully follow. So.
Yeah, but you also would then be aware of what the journals are actually willing to do, rather than discussing things that actually it's difficult to know what length the journals are willing to go to.
Right.
I also think if we do get a number of journals that get on board, I think it's worthwhile letting people know that the curators prioritize them for curation because of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we need to have information about what the journals are going to be willing to do, because somebody needs to check. If you've got 6 genes in a paper and they only put 4 in their list, who's going to enforce that the other 2 need to be done?
Left.
Automatic editors say table incomplete. Please fix.
Yeah, but you don't know that unless you read the paper, right?
Yeah, somebody has to check that.
Right. I mean, so that's their editorial board.
Well, ultimately, though, I mean, I think you can enforce a certain amount, but you're never going to get past a certain level of compliance.
Yeah,
I mean, people are going to say, you know, their control for their northern or whatever wasn't really important enough.
Yeah, and so then we don't capture it. You know, maybe we should capture the information the community think is important. If it's not worth looking up the ID, maybe it's just.
Yeah, I mean, right, there's going to be a certain level of compliance to this. You know, with gene names, some of the communities have better compliance than others. You know, it's certainly going to depend on the journal and the type of paper that's being looked at, because the reviewers, you know, in some cases will care if it's genetics, and other cases they don't.
Right.
If some other thought that I've just had is that I'm being asked to write lots of papers for human biology kind of journals, because people are getting interested in GO, and we're trying to write in and explain that more and more people are going to the big databases and they're just picking up the GO terms and they're finding the references, and that it is in the author's interest to have a curatable paper.
Well,
maybe we could get the journals, when we're talking to journals in the future, to say, could we write an editorial for your journal to explain what the problem is, or at least try and get more editorials out there to the broader community.
One of the things we've talked about at RGD, because with all of our ontology annotations, it's, you know, there's a hyperlink with the reference, is the ability to track how many times people go from our database, because we have the annotations, to the papers itself. So how often are we directing people to the papers of most interest to them? I think it's a metric that a lot of us haven't thought about much, but this is in fact what people do, and that's how they get to these papers. And I think it'd be worthwhile looking at trying to track some of that.
Track that even if they go through PubMed, if they go from you guys to PubMed to the paper?
So what this is what I'm trying to work with our software people is, can we track that? How many times do people click on that link to the paper?
Yes, it is traceable. Technically, it's possible. So then it is actually a good idea, I think, just to see how many times the someone who goes on your site goes then to PubMed ID.
Yeah.
And to the paper. So this is probably useful. It can be a selling point for smaller journals that are trying to get people published. That you can, they can advertise, like, you know, if you publish here, maybe our citation index is not that high, but you see we've got people going to our papers because we're curated on time in a gazillion of databases, and the information is visible.
And this is a real benefit to the author because it increases the probability that his or her paper will in fact be cited by someone,
mm-hmm.
because they've been drawn to it.
Exactly. So, I mean, a few days ago, actually, I did get a message from PLOS Biology, I think, or one of those journals, actually being very proud that whatever paper we've published got visited a certain number of times because we might be interested in that. So this is the way to persuade authors that, oh, you've got audience.
Yeah, we track where users go from our database by having a little redirect mechanism. We noticed other sort of commercial sites and various things doing that. And so it's always easy to tell where they came from into your site, but going out, you don't know. And so we add a little this redirect so we actually explicitly know what page that they clicked on and where they went.
Yeah, so it's technically not a problem. Uh-oh.
Well, this has been very valuable. We dealt with we took an hour to deal with this. So since the meeting is scheduled for an hour, you know, we can go on for a little bit longer. But I don't think we should start in on another topic. Okay. Well, so it sounds like there's a few things that folks could be sending around. I know there's mentioned a few of those, and I'll try to come up with an idea for a place that we can communicate without the email, just so it can give a little bit of a record, something like a wiki or whatever, to do that. And then we can each talk about various questions. So as we've been going through it, I've been writing down questions that I could list there, and everybody could try to answer it based on their experience or their project or where they think things should go. So I think this has been very, very useful, very interesting to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But, and I was counting as in the very beginning I asked who was present, and then as going through I detected some new people. So my number is that there's 35 people on the call. So.
Wow.
I came in after attendance of taking Mike's false number here. Sorry.
Yeah, I noted a few folks.
I have a note for my daughter.
Is there anything else anybody wants to add or mention, announce, whatever?
Well, this is Tanya. I'm hoping that in the next month or two, I'll be able to give you a report on how our collaboration with PlantSys is going. So far, we haven't gotten any data submissions yet, but that's because the form has gone live and they have, you know, 56 days between submission and acceptance. So there isn't anybody actually that would be ready to fill out the form. So anyway, when we do have data, I'll tell you about it.
Okay, so as I said, there's going to be this HOOPA PSI meeting. There are going to be people there who are dealing with FEPs, with the interaction submission by the author. So I'll try to talk to those people and see what actually they get out of it. And then maybe there's going to be a way to somehow get a common position on contacting the journals. So this is one thing. And then second thing is we are about to go after PNAS with the interaction data to try to persuade authors or journals to somehow get authors' cooperation, but maybe it's reasonable to contact them in a broader sense and see what's possible in terms of more general information extraction from the authors. So we'll see what's going to happen here. But.
Yeah, I think this should be some kind of you know, even if it's informal, you know, group that would take charge for mediating all the requests. Because otherwise, I think it's going to get really disorganized for the journals.
Yeah.
It's fine if everybody puts in a request, and I'm sure there's like 10 or 15 of these things going on right now. We probably don't even know them all on this phone call. But right, just to sort of say, look, we're going to have some way of arguing about them.
This is Rama again from SGD. So PDB, the Protein Data Bank, they require that all the whoever publishes a paper on a protein structure, they have to submit the coordinates to PDB. It's kind of mandatory. And they've somehow worked out with many journals so that the coordinates are submitted to PDB, and then you get an ID from PDB, and you have to make that ID available in your paper as a footnote or something like that. Maybe we should talk to PDB and find out how they worked with the journals to make this requirement.
It's actually not PDB. It's actually journals that require.
No, no, no. PDB lobbied to get this, but in a way, it was kind of easier because they're a single organism, you know, database, and they can just...
But the point is that enforcing entity is not PDB. PDB negotiated with journals so that they require submission and...
Right,
and
exactly. So this is a sort of what we want to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
But the point is to have one entity, just one group that asks for that instead of five different...
Yeah,
groups,
that's
so,
it.
Because otherwise everybody's going to get confused and they're going to say no because, I mean,
right.
we don't know who to talk to. So.
Yeah.
Right, right. Okay, the last thing is, though, should we try to set a regular time for this call, or should I continue doing one of the doodles every time? So trying to set something up for May would be the next thing.
Just set it up.
A regular time or the doodle?
I don't know.
Okay, well, I'll start with a doodle and we can see where we go. So.
Bye, everyone. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
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 Thanks.
Bye.
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 Left.
Cecilia Dini from PIR. I'm Unibrook.
Left.
Sonia Berardini, CARE.
Left.
Leila Bayraktarolu.
Left.
Ruth.
Left.
Jody Hirschman.
Left.
Guy Plunkett.
Left.
Stasha.
Left.
Hi, this is Caltech, Warm Base.
Left.
Kate Dreyer.
Left.
Pascal.
Left.
Steve Stafford.
Left. Thank you. Please stand by.